Welcome to the podcast, Song of the Soulmate, Hymn of the Muse. I'm Dr. Neil Lundgren. At that very moment when an intense love dawns between two persons, the angel of inspiration appears. I've often wondered about the function of the muse as the one who inspires in all relationships, whether an anonymous or famous one. My sense is that many couples experience the passion of intimacy as a beginning stage of infatuation. When two people fall in love, songs and poetry are often shared and even written for one another, even if neither of the two who are in love had ever penned one word of prose or written one song before. When two are in love, the world around them appears as if transfigured, and sometimes downright invisible. Both walk through their day with a bounce in their step, and report that even colors are more vivid, and little annoyances that used to bother them can't seem to penetrate their positive energy field. Each has a sense of confidence about life and have a shared belief that they can endure any trial with strength and grace. But then something happens. Infatuated love often loses its original luster. The intensity of the earth's brilliance by the sun and the moon begins to fade. And what was initially a blazing fire becomes a heap of smoldering embers, eventually turning into pale gray ashes. Could it be that the muse is fickle or needs to be attended to, even given an altar or some elevated space adorned with a single flower, a stone, or a cup filled with some ambrosia, elixir, something delicious to taste or smell? Perhaps a love naturally ends, and should, because its purpose has been fulfilled. Perhaps there are some loves who simply neglected to nurture or listen to the quiet song of the muse who started the fire to begin with. This was apparently not the case for Marc and Bella Chagall. Even in death, his beloved soulmate continued to function as his inspiration. There is a painting that is not as well known as many of his others. It is called Anniversary Flowers. It depicts the artist before his easel on the anniversary of his wife's death. He's come to the canvas for an astral meeting with his beloved. In the painting, Marc's face is turned away from his own work of art, yet he appears that he's in reverie, with his hand outstretched to Bella, a ghostly figure. Just above the canvas of red and gold blossoms, her spirit has come to greet him. What a love this must have been, even after Bella's physical death. A notebook that Chagall kept for 20 years after Bella's passing was recently found, and excerpts appeared in the British online newspaper, The Telegraph. According to the reporter's account, it was apparent from the content of the notebook that Bella's sudden death at the age of 49 devastated the artist. And after his wife died in 1944 from a viral infection, the grieving Chagall kept her diary, which he illustrated for the next 20 years, sketching on the blank pages and surrounding Bella's writings with colorful and moving posthumous portraits of her and the two of them together. In one sketch, Bella is depicted in a patterned dress with a bowl of fruit, while another drawing shows her with dark circles around her eyes, possibly depicting her final illness. The couple also appear together throughout the journal, with Chagall recalling their wedding day in 1919 in a pen and ink drawing of them as bride and groom. In a most moving image, Chagall, with a blue face and melancholy expression, is seated at his easel again, contemplating a painting in red of himself and Bella. In one hand, reaches out to touch the canvas, with his other hand held to his heart. Another etching captures the artist's vivid imagination, featuring a walking double bass with the flowing mane of hair in the shape of a violin, and a collection of mermaids. Bella's influence of the painter never went away. In fact, it permeated everything Marc Chagall did, even 20 years after her death. In her memoirs, Bella wrote of their first meeting in these words, "I was surprised at his eyes. They were so blue as the sky. I'm lowering my eyes. Nobody is saying anything. We both feel our hearts beating." In his own autobiography, Marc wrote of his first encounter with Bella. "Her silence is mine. Her eyes, mine. It is as if she knows everything about my childhood, my present, my future, as if she can see right through me, as if she has always watched over me, somewhere next to me, though I saw her for the very first time. I knew this is she, my wife, her pale coloring, her eyes. How big and round and black they are. They are my eyes, my soul." Until her death, Bella appeared in some of his most famous works, including Bella with White Collar, rendered in 1917. Though Chagall remarried in 1952, his second wife, Valentina Brodsky, rarely appeared in his work, and Bella continued to act as his muse, his lifelong inspiration. So this leads me to ask, what is a soulmate? Is there such a thing? And how do I know whether I will in the future or have already met my beloved in human form? I ask you, have you met your soulmate in this lifetime? Or will you in the great beyond, that is in the next life, if you believe in such a transition of a post-mortal existence? One of the most intriguing of muse pairs in history, I believe, was Lou Andreas Salome and Rainer Maria Rilke. I was first introduced to the correspondence between Lou and Rilke as a doctoral student, poring over their letters in my university's book stacks long before there was such a thing as Google or an online library. I sense then and intuit now that Lou was a woman of significant capacity of soul. She was a prolific writer and penned several little-known novels, plays, and essays. She authored A Hymn to Life that so deeply impressed Nietzsche that he was moved to set it to music. Although she was 15 years his senior, Lou's relationship with Rilke was particularly close. They first met when he was 21 and were lovers for several years and corresponded on profound themes of life and death until Rilke's passing. Lou taught the poet Russian so that he could read the novels of Tolstoy, whom he would later meet, as well as the writer Pushkin. She also introduced him to patrons and other people in the arts and remained his advisor, confidant, and muse throughout his adult life. Outside of a few intimate encounters that made a lasting imprint on the poet, Lou maintained a distance from him through most of his life, choosing instead to maintain the economic security of a conventional marriage. Conjugal fidelity was not among Lou's virtues. She also played the muse for Nietzsche and Freud, who were both captivated by her beauty and remarkable intelligence. However, The outpouring of Lou's heart and soul to Rilke after his death are stunning to behold, and indicate that she not only loved, but deeply saw into Rilke's soul. In other words, understood who he was at the very core of his being, his core consciousness. In her own words to her lover, written in 1927, a year after the poet's death, she said, "If for years I was your woman, it was because you were for me the first real truth, undeniable proof of life itself. Word for word, I could have repeated to you what you said to me as a confession of love. You alone are real to me. With these words, we were wed before we had even become friends. Two halves did not seek completion in each other, but a surprised whole recognized itself in an unfathomable totality." Let's read that last line again. Two halves did not seek completion in each other, but a surprised whole recognized itself in an unfathomable totality. During his life, a number of poems spilled from Rilke's soul, inspired by his muse and lover, Lou. "How shall I hold on to my soul so that it does not touch yours? How shall I lift it gently up over you onto other things? And yet everything which touches us, you and me, takes us together like a single bow, drawing out from two strings but one voice." Recently, I came across a passage on relationships from a monk. Yes, believe it or not, a monk. His name was Thomas Merton, a Carthusian recluse and poet-writer who dwelled alone in the woods of an abbey in Kentucky. One might think that a monk would know little of such things as human love. Numerous visitors did seek Merton out, including Krishnamurti. He would come to my abbey in the north woods of Minnesota whenever he had to get away from the drama of his own cloister, although this was long before I had entered this monastery. He writes, "But to love another as a person, we must begin by granting them their own autonomy and identity as a person. We have to love them for what they are in themselves, and not for what they are to us. We have to love them for their own good, not for the good we get out of them. And this is impossible unless we are capable of a love which transforms us, so to speak, into the other person, making us able to see things as they see them, love what they love, experience the deeper realities of their own life as if their lives were our own. Unless we are capable of this kind of transformation into the other while remaining ourselves, we are not yet capable of a fully human existence." What insight this celibate man gives us into the possibilities of mature love between two persons, be it a friendship with someone, with or without a sexual component of expression. What Merton is expressing here is what I have been working to induce in my many couples who've crossed my door over the years. It is love in its most practical, real, and altruistic form. What we're talking about here is empathy. Empathy in its highest vibration and frequency, to transform into the other while remaining ourselves. What an exquisite definition of empathy. What an exquisite idea of a kind of soulmate love that doesn't have to tenuously exist in a bubble somewhere, frightened of the world's winds and storms. Over the course of my time as a mentor, I've heard many accounts of soulmate loves, some illicit and some lawful, some that were too fragile and weak to sustain the challenges of life in the concrete world of curveballs and minefields, economic struggles and windfalls, stresses of parenting children, of all manner of physical, mental, and emotional liability. The modern philosopher-poet David White writes on the true meaning of friendship and love. He says that heartbreak is a sure sign of sincerity in a relationship. That is to say, you're still on the shore with your sandcastles, too cowardly to throw yourself in the ring, into the ocean to be tossed and torn and even drowned by the deep waves of soul energy, unless you really dive in. What you may or may not know is that all love is practice. Throughout your life, all your loves, in whatever form of expression, are calling forth in you exercises in building a Herculean strength, a strength that it takes to unfurl into infinite consciousness and eventually to be annihilated by love itself. Our bodies may be here to build physical muscle, but our souls are here to unfold its organs of perception so that we can be prepared for the tests that will come again and still again from each and all of those we confess to love. And that is why our soul is more connected really to our heart than our brain. In fact, you know, when we look at it, the heart is timeless. And there's really no such thing as time. There are only episodes of our heart and our soul's learning and teaching, excursions into achieving mastery of the soul's undisciplined emotions while in its heart, to listen to the wisdom within and to speak words of encouragement as every soul around us pilgrims through this world of joys and sorrows alongside one another. In the end, perhaps, it is our soul's original source, the infinite beating heart of infinite mind, who is our ultimate soulmate, our ultimate muse, whose purpose is to companion with us and to inspire us to see with the eyes of our soul. In that way, we will come to embrace and to love both our big and small adventures by truly becoming the other while remaining ourselves. That is, until we are, in the words of the monk lover Thomas Merton, capable of a love which transforms us into the other person, making us able to see things as they see them, love what they love, and experience the deeper realities of their own life as if their lives were our very own. Thank you.